And now let's move on to item five, which is one of the main attractions today, which is a review of our total portfolio performance for the period ending December 31, 2022. And I think we're going to have Scott Whelan join us. In fact, I know he is. And there he is coming on. And Mr. Price, I think, is coming on as well. So let's just give a moment for Tim to join. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you.
All right. Excellent.
So
there's Mr. Price. I just was waiting for Tim to, the boxes move around on my screen here. So Tim joined it. There he is. He's moved again. There. Good morning. All right. So let me tee this up. And Tim, I'm going to, unless you want to go directly to Scott, I was going to give it to you. If not, I will turn it over to Mr. Whelan.
I am happy to turn this over directly to Mr. Whelan, given that this is a report directly to the board. So, Scott, all yours.
Thank you very much. That
works. Thank you.
So I will make a couple of comments about the economic environment and then move right into performance. So the economic landscape has been interesting for sure. We've had a couple of major market pivots over the last 12 to 18 months. Starting in the fourth quarter of 2021, where the word transitory, as describing inflation, really sort of went by the wayside and everybody started to become more worried about inflation, which has really driven markets in one form or another since. The Fed started on an aggressive rate hiking regime, and they hiked several times through 2022. The market, of course, looked at those rising rates and decided that valuations at the beginning of 2022 were high. And so you saw pretty big drawdown, pretty big pullback in risk assets as those risk assets repriced in anticipation of rising rates. At the end of 2022, the market sort of decided that maybe inflation was going to be beaten and the Fed was going to slow. And so that was the second sort of market pivot. Towards the end of the fourth quarter of last year, you saw markets really begin a fairly significant comeback. And that has continued through the first quarter of this year with quite a bit of market volatility. What appears to be going on is there's this real friction between rising rates to head off inflation and what that may do to economic growth, right? And that's the Fed's intention. They're raising rates to slow economic growth to beat back inflation. And when the market feels like the Fed is getting the job done, you see risk assets rise. When they feel like there's risk of additional rate hikes, you see risk assets fall. And then the of course, unknown factor here is what it's going to do to growth and what it's going to do to earnings. The market really seems to have discounted in reasonably well the rate hikes. It doesn't seem to be paying too much attention to potential earnings recession and slower economic growth, sort of anticipating that soft landing. So that's the real push and pull that's taking place in markets, not only domestically, but internationally as well. And then, of course, you've got the big wild cards in what's going on with China and what's going on in Europe with the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. In China, you've got reopening from COVID. So pretty much zero tolerance for COVID and what that was doing to production and what that was doing as a knock-on effect to supply chains and inflation impact. And then, of course, with Europe and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you also had additional supply chain impact with respect to energy and food, of course, also having additional inflationary impacts. So those things remain big question marks. Of course, coming back to the original question of what's going to happen to inflation and what's going to happen to growth and how the market is responding. Currently, the market is responding relatively favorably with ongoing volatility.
Hey, Scott.
I'll pause there for questions. McDonald.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, with respect to China, there's a couple of forces you might want to comment on. One is the demographic situation in China, where its manufacturing capabilities may not be what they used to be, especially going forward. I understand they're going to be losing millions of their workforce going forward. And then the other thing is, because of the tensions, it seemed like a lot of relationships have been enhanced in Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and also in Latin America. So it seems like China may not be quite the driver that it was in the past with respect to foreign investment and reliance on goods and so forth.
So it sounds like you're specifically talking about manufacturing capacity from a couple of different perspectives, one being demographic, the other being potentially geopolitical tensions. Is that sort of fair?
Yeah.
Summation? Yeah. So with respect to demographics, I don't have any keen insights on how that's expected to impact their ability to manufacture. I mean, they remain today still the largest producer of global goods, right? Global consumer goods. To your point, the U.S. is sourcing elsewhere and slowly moving away from China. So Vietnam, Latin America, even re-onsourcing back into the U.S. So the you know, global manufacturing should slowly be moving away from China, whether it's demographic or geopolitical reasons. I don't really have a great answer to that, but you're seeing manufacturing slowly moving away from China. You know, there was an interesting story that I saw just this morning that is sort of related, and it's how China now is encouraging state-owned companies to move away from big four accounting firms and use local accounting firms. I got to imagine that that's going to have sort of a chilling effect on investments going into China, notwithstanding, you know, any relationship to manufacturing, but just thinking about investments and how investments in China, you know, it's really not the environment that it was 5, 10, 15 years ago.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
I think that move with the auditors and whatnot, or the funds or the administrators you're talking about, can fairly be described as simply a trial balloon.
Thanks for that.
I think there was humor in that, but I'm not sure. John?
It's really bad when I have to say yes.
I'm going to withdraw my sense of a question here. So go ahead.
Sorry, Jerry, I missed that, but it was fairly obvious.
It was subtle. It was pretty subtle.
Yeah, and pretty good given you know, given a little bit of thought.
Okay. Well, it looks like everybody else has their hands down, so go ahead and continue, Scott.
So unless there are any more questions on my general sort of economic comments, I'm going to share my screen and take you to the detailed index returns slide, which is one of the last slides in the first part of the deck. It's on page 47, but I will share here.
All right.
Couple of points I want to make here. Turn to my notes page. So you can see a lot of red on this page. You can see kind of the pivots that I talked about, the one-year numbers being really pretty negative across asset classes. You can also see the return to kind of a risk-on sentiment in the fourth quarter. And then you look back at the 10-year number and really strong, and I'm just looking at the S&P 500 as a proxy for risk on assets here. The chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page, the first row, 12.6% on an average annualized basis over 10 years is quite a bit higher than your typical 10-year return over the history of the S&P 500, which might be more in line with a 9 to 10% return. So still, despite the COVID drawdown and recovery, still strong returns, and still, in that sort of snapback going all the way back to the global financial crisis. Couple of other points to make. So, and this is going to flow through to some comments I make about portfolio performance. If you look at some differences within equity market returns, you can go down to sort of the lower half of that chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page and look at the difference between large cap. Actually, I'll take you back up to the top half, the Russell 1000 large cap stocks and the Russell 2000 small cap stocks. So you may know that over time, small cap stocks are expected to provide a premium over large cap stocks. They're just expected to return more. The idea is that those smaller companies are riskier, they have more volatility, and you're expected to get a higher return. Well, if you look back over 5 years, 10 years, large cap stocks have really outperformed pretty handily. So over the long term, that small cap premium just has not been there. Similarly, taking you down to the chart on the lower left-hand portion of the page, you look at emerging markets stocks represented by the MSCI EM index there versus developed international stocks represented by the MSCI EFI index. And you can see the idea there is that emerging markets should outperform over the long term in terms of performance, in terms of returns. And you can see here, similarly, developed stocks have really outperformed emerging market stocks pretty handily over the intermediate to long term. So a couple of trends are not following sort of where they ought to be theoretically when you think of it in terms of a risk return framework.
Scott, let me interrupt you for a second on the emerging markets index. What's the weight in that for China and the other participants?
That is a really good question, and I think I have that handy. If you just give me a second, let's see if I can.
You seem to recall it's significant, but I just can't remember the number.
Yeah, it is.
It's roughly a third today in China.
So I'm going to stop looking because we just got a good heuristic there.
Excellent. Thank you.
I was wondering about that, but Scott, it goes back. Over the past few years, that seems like China's really dragged that down. But going back to the 10-year, it's still quite a significant difference.
Yeah, that's right. And that's important. It's an important point. I'm going to relate that to your portfolio performance momentarily. So a couple other points on this slide.
Is there any green ink on here?
Yeah. Well, it's red and black, so there's not a ton of black ink, but it's not as bad as it's been in the past. In terms of at some point, not too long ago, there was a lot of red on this page. Most of it red. Here you can look at rates risk, right? Fixed income on the upper right-hand portion of your page. A real interesting point here is if you look at this long-term treasury for the one-year number. So this is a U.S. government bond, think long-term, think 30 years. And there's no credit risk in there. It's all rate risk. So as rates move up, discounted future cash flows become less valuable today. And you can see that 29.3% for essentially, you're going to get paid back. In a year, it lost about a third of its value. That's lower or a greater loss than even the S&P 500. So more risk in long-term treasuries, which really highlights the impact that those rising rates had on fixed income securities. And then, you know, similarly, you look at the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. So that's a nice diversified portfolio of corporate credit, government bonds, more intermediate term government bonds, and mortgage-backed securities, down 13%. So fixed income wasn't really much of an anchor to windward over the last year. And then real estate. So looking at the Wilshire U.S. REIT Index, again, over the year, real estate down 26.8%. So, you know, sort of the big categories that make up most institutional portfolios, stocks, bonds, and real estate, there wasn't really much of a place to hide over the last year. And with that, I will pause for questions before moving into performance.
In terms of, Jerry, you had your hand up, but before I call on Scott, just to follow up on the real estate item, I read somewhere recently that the longer-term COVID effect on the commercial real estate space is going to start being evident as leases wind down. Existing leases come towards the end of their term and that space frees up. Are you seeing that, hearing that? Because it sounds like a transition time, but yeah, it's unclear.
Yeah, so we are seeing that, and we're seeing some marks. We saw it a little bit in the fourth quarter. We're seeing some valuation marks dropping for those open-ended funds that have sort of, you know, the REITs that I just showed you. That's a daily mark. It's like a stock, so it's valued daily. The open-end funds are slower to mark down. They only value themselves quarterly, and that typically they're only valuing a quarter of the portfolio quarterly. But we began to see that in the fourth quarter. I'm expecting that we'll see more of that going forward. So those open-ended funds should catch up with the REIT valuations. You know, what's going to happen in office in commercial real estate is really going to be interesting. Just as kind of a anecdotally, I was in a hotel room in Chicago not too long ago. I was there for most of the week, and I was looking out my window on a daily basis, and I was seeing the big office building across the street. And I would say that on any given day while I was there, it was maybe 15 to 20% occupied. And you just wonder so these are knowledge workers that can work from home, and they've got rules by their companies as to when they have to come in. You just have to wonder what's going to happen to those millions of square feet of unoccupied office space. And I've talked to a lot of real estate managers, and they're saying, you know, there's definitely going to be a reckoning. We're not really sure what's going to happen to it. You know, maybe some of it will be repurposed, but if you think about it, it costs $300+ per square foot to change an office building into a residential or a condo building. And the economics of that don't seem particularly viable. So it's really interesting to see what's going to happen in that space.
Yeah, I was driving to the airport the other day and just looked at the Salesforce Tower as I was going down, you know, past the city of Oakland. And I thought, from what I understand, it's largely empty. And I thought, I don't know how that works. That's a lot of square footage to keep the lights on for, to have a pretty effect on the skyline. And I've heard the same thing you're hearing, that there are a number of plans both in Los Angeles, San Francisco, major metropolitan markets to transition, convert the office, excess office capacity to residential. Although I'm told the better play is for older commercial, right? So that the more viable conversion is older, not the shiny glass tower commercial, but the older, you know, 20-year-old plus commercial that might be more amenable to a conversion. Don't know, but it just feels like we're on an ice lake that is starting to fracture, and I'm a little concerned.
Yeah, that one is going to be a big wait and see. You never know what's going to happen or how it's going to play out, but it sure seems like a lot of that unused real estate is going to, something's going to have to happen to it to reevaluate.
So, Jerry, I'm sorry, you were patient.
You've largely covered, other people have covered most of the points. I would only add, I saw an article yesterday that said that the average vacancy in major markets office buildings is now 50% or 48%, roughly that. And one of the biggest things in real estate, aside from repurposing, is debt service. Hardly any of these buildings are owned outright.
Right.
And so I would imagine, I wouldn't be surprised to see a considerable amount of restructuring of debt service in the next couple of years. And I don't know whether or not that's one of those buy on the dips. That's really going to be a test for people that have got stronger will than I might have to dive into that. But you might be able to pick up some buildings for not too much money in the coming months.
Yeah.
It's going to be a real test of will and courage on somebody's part.
Yeah, I expect there'll be money lost and money made, and hopefully there'll be opportunities for you all through that process as well.
But then the question is, if you buy those buildings, what do you do with them? So even though you get them on the cheap, you know they're just kind of sitting there. But Scott, I wanted to ask you about our exposure to office. And in the past with private equity investments, I know there was a good portion of office included. And I think going forward, we're much more cognizant of office exposure, but how much of our portfolio is kind of at risk with this office phenomenon?
Yeah, so to your point, the things that your team is looking at now are de-emphasizing office. And I don't have a good sense, just off the top of my head, what portion of your portfolio is dedicated to office currently. And Tim, I don't know if you have a sense of that or are able to comment on that.
Yeah, and just taking a look at the last report we had from Verus back in August, office was roughly a quarter of our real estate exposure, and that's all legacy pre-pandemic office space. It is a significant portion of the investable universe. It was a significant portion of the legacy portfolio. Once COVID came, we paused all real estate allocations for about a year. When we restarted, it was, going into more specialty spaces rather than large diversified funds. But, we have a couple of managers we have allocated recently who have in their mandate the ability to opportunistically pursue dislocated office buildings. They have not done so to date. So,
interesting. That's helpful. Thank you, Tim.
Okay.
All right, Scott, carry on.
So I'll share my screen again in a moment, but before I do, I just want to make a couple of key points around performance. So while absolute and relative performance has improved over the past couple of quarters, the portfolio is not really meeting expectations currently. The funds enjoyed solid performance overall since moving to the functionally focused portfolio, and it's only natural for periods of disappointing performance to occur periodically. I will point out, and I think you guys are all very aware, that patience is a virtue when it comes to performance management. Too often, decision makers make changes right at the wrong time, and many studies have convincingly proven as much. However, complacency can be detrimental as well. You may recall last month we looked at performance attribution in depth and discovered the underperformance was primarily attributable to three things. A private equity benchmarking issue really explained the lion's share of it. International equity manager underperformance that we determined, wasn't systemic. And the overlay program and timing of putting cash to work. So those three things explained a good chunk of the underperformance. And as such, we weren't particularly concerned. And while there are no screaming red flags, currently there are some yellow flags that have been stubbornly persistent. Tim and I agree that there are a few structural adjustments and possibly some manager changes that may make sense. And we're going to be looking at that hard over the next couple of months. We have a
strategic asset allocation review due in April that may give us some information that leads to some recommendations. Before we get to the specific areas, let's take a look at the portfolio overall to sort of set the stage, and then we'll have a brief discussion about some potentially structural issues, some of which I alluded to in my economic comments around emerging markets, small cap, et cetera. So with that, I will share my screen again. Okay.
I can get you a drum roll if you want. That screen.
Okay, so here you can see the total fund portfolio reconciliation as of December 31st for the last 3 months and the year to date.
Hey, Scott, let me interrupt you for a second. So at least on my screen, the screen isn't shared. If you're looking at a shared screen, we're not. So
thank you for that.
Yeah, I just didn't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to let you know. There we go. Now you're cooking.
Thank you. So total fund portfolio reconciliation period ending December 31st. So this takes you through to the end of the last quarter. You can see the year to date. So that's the entire calendar year of 2022, beginning market value of $11.5 billion, tough year, investment change down $1.1 or $1.2 billion, leaving you with $10.2 billion. So at the beginning of the fourth quarter, your market value of 9.9, and then you can see the fourth quarter started to come back, of course, bringing you to that same $10.2 billion at the end of the calendar year. Taking you to the asset allocation. So this is just sort of a governance check of the current allocation relative to the policy. You can see that you're in line with long-term targets, I guess more importantly, in line with your current targets on your way to your long-term targets. So growth, liquidity, diversifying, and then this cash, which is sort of spread back across the three major investment buckets. So in line with your policy targets, and then moving to performance. So you can see here, so no surprises, right? The one-year number still reflective of those issues that we pointed out when we did our attribution deep dive. So underperformance there. Looking at the quarter, so you're coming close to your benchmark. The total fund returned 4.1%, policy index 4.5. The adjusted policy index really is just historically looking at the numbers as they would have been if we'd been using that private markets benchmarking methodology back into the past. So good information there, but currently, it's the same policy index and adjusted. So 40 basis points below your policy index, not too concerning there, given that this is a portfolio that typically protects on the downside and keeps up on the upside. So good information there. 5.2 versus 5.5 in the growth portfolio, 30 basis points below the benchmark, partially due to an emerging markets overweight relative to that benchmark. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then diversifying, here is where the challenge was for the quarter. Minus 1.5% versus 2.1%. I will point out that this is a tough benchmark to beat. A lot of this diversifying benchmark is a cash plus benchmark. And so anything that was affected by rates, like your AFL, CIO, mortgage-backed securities strategy, you saw that big red number in the fixed income table. That really impacted your diversifying sleeve. And we're going to get into that a little bit as well. And then liquidity, some good performance there. Moving to the next slide, you can see this is just kind of a high level attribution that shows where the impact came from. So in both cases, it was selection effect, that is managers underperforming their benchmarks. You know, not huge. These bars look big and thick, but if you look down here at the scale, it's between 20 and 40 basis points for diversifying and growth relative to their benchmarks. So selection effect in the growth and diversifying portfolios is what led to that 40 basis points of underperformance overall. And then diving into the details a little bit. So here's where we can kind of pick it apart. So the growth portfolio, 5.2 versus 5.5, you can see domestic equity outperformed solidly. So your domestic managers, both near-term and long-term, looking pretty good. You can see the benchmark relative performance and the ranks all look pretty good down the line. And then we come to your international equity, a little bit of underperformance there. Pierford and William Blair, your two international, so developed international equity managers, right? We've talked about these guys and shown that they showed some underperformance and some outperformance over periods, no systemic issues. So for example, with Pierford, you can look back at good outperformance over the year. And then you look at their very long-term numbers, and both of these managers have outperformed handily so over the period that you've had them. And then you look at emerging markets. So here I'm going to make a structural point. You can see your emerging market is at your emerging market equity exposure is 6.5% of the total portfolio. It's not that much lower than your international equity exposure. It makes up about 16% of your total equity exposure. And if you look at emerging markets as a portion of the investable universe, it makes up only about 11% of the total global equity universe, right? So you guys are overweight emerging market equity, particularly relative to your international equity. And then you look at the performance, and you can see that that's the point I was making on that previous slide when I was talking about the economic landscape. You would expect emerging markets to outperform over time. The performance relative to just developed has been lower. It's struggled, right? So there's a structural issue there. And structurally, that has caused some of your underperformance in the growth portfolio. So that's something that Tim and I have talked about and we'll be looking at when we conduct the strategic asset allocation review coming up in April.
So Scott, let me just stop you right there. So yeah. In terms of bigger picture optics of this, and not optics, that's the wrong word, because I'm really thinking about how these numbers on a comparative basis stack up to what other funds have experienced. Do other funds that you're aware of have similar challenges in similar categories? And how do we stack up relative to them? Because ultimately we get a lot of those questions amongst us from members of the public and other public officials about,
That's a good question. So this isn't a huge bet in your portfolio, right? You're not putting everything on black. In other words, putting everything on emerging markets. It's a strategic tilt to overweight emerging markets with the expectation that emerging markets over time will outperform. It hasn't. And so the question is, what's the expectation going forward? And that's what we need to take a hard look at and we'll be reviewing before the April board meeting.
Well, but my question still is, I guess it was maybe a two-part question, which is maybe it's two slides prior, which is how does that fourth quarter and 2022 in general across these sectors compare to other funds' experience?
Yeah. So let's see.
if I can answer that question somewhere else in the deck. I don't think I have that slide. Yeah. So we do have a slide that, or an analysis that sometimes we include that shows relative allocation relative to a peer median. I don't have that. I think, just intuitively, I think you're high relative to peers, but again, not, remarkably high. And I can come back to you on that.
Okay.
Okay. Does that,
at some point, and maybe we just need to plow through the rest. I want to get an overall sense of the comparator to sister systems.
Yeah,
where we sit relative to peers, because I want to be sure we all understand that. And I see Jerry Holcomb has his hand up. Jerry.
Yeah, and I will, before I Jerry asks this question, I'll just respond that I will take that question back and certainly bring that answer back to you, maybe at the April Strategic Asset Allocation Review, but I'll get that back to you.
Okay. All right.
Thanks. Jerry. Sorry, Jerry.
Will this, thanks, Scott. Will this look at... that structural discussions about emerging markets also look at the possibility of literally an ex-China policy theory? Because my sense is that this geopolitical situation with China is not going to get better. It's just one person's opinion. Instead, it's going to probably continue to get worse. Some of our managers would say, well, we can't do our fund without China. And I don't know whether or not that's a threat, probably not. It's more a matter of almost an invitation, a suggestion. Yeah. If you need to look at other returns, then look elsewhere and look at other funds. And a lot of that stuff is being manufacturing stuff is moving now. It's in the process of moving to the Thailands and the Cambodias and Philippines and whatnot. And I'd like to see us look at what we might be able to do ex-China.
Yeah.
Number one, I don't believe any of the numbers that are coming out of China. And certainly the numbers we're getting are not great. So I just wondered if that's at least an option we're going to take a look at.
So it's a great question. Asia ex China is not sort of an investment alternative that is widely available, right? So or EM ex China. There's not a lot of EM ex China strategies out there. Now, there are regional strategies, like you could just go get a Japan fund, for example. And you could cobble together kind of an Asia ex China by using a number of different managers and a number of different mandates. But it wouldn't be just a simple, okay, there's 30 managers out there that have a strategy that's Asia ex or EM ex China. So a little bit tougher to do than it sounds. But the easy answer is just reduce your emerging market exposure, and you would be reducing your China exposure considerably, as Tim alluded to earlier. But definitely, what things that we'll be looking at.
I definitely think that in the near future, if things continue to go the way they are, that there's going to be some question about repatriation of funds that we have in China. They're going to make it more difficult to get out. And that puts us in a very interesting position if we don't have more flexibility than that.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate the comments. And then looking at risk parity is another area that we'll be spending some time on. Tim and I have gone back and forth on risk parity over the years. The environment has changed such that now a big chunk of what is in risk parity, the rates risk or fixed income risk, is more attractive now, right? With rates off zero, the levers that risk parity managers have to pull just seem more attractive now. So we're going to be taking a look at that as well. And then in the diversifying portfolio, so here is, the
the biggest component. It's a small portion of the portfolio overall, right? Just 7.5%. But you can see the impact of that underperformance was meaningful. And a lot of it came from that rates exposure that I showed, that one column of red in the returns table. And you can see here your AFL-CIO mandate, which is largely mortgage-backed securities with an implicit government guarantee, followed that down. You can see some underperformance, slight underperformance over time relative to that Bloomberg aggregate benchmark. But this portion of your portfolio just wasn't particularly diversifying. We're going to be taking a look at that. And then also, I know that your investment staff is also looking at the correlation of this diversifying sleeve relative to the risk sleeve and trying to improve that correlation. They've been looking at including a trend following mandate in here and seeing what that does to it structurally and whether that improves the correlation. But this will also be a big part of what we look at during that strategic asset allocation review.
But they've still beat the benchmark over time, right? I mean, that's what the far right column tells me anyway.
Yeah, and they've been with you forever.
Yeah, right, long time.
Yeah, the question is, does it still make sense? And does the future look like the past? And that's what we'll be trying to determine.
Got it. Yeah, understood.
And with that, really, I have no additional comments. Just wanted to kind of give you a heads up that, as I mentioned, no screaming red flags, but some persistent yellow flags that we're going to try and see if it makes sense to make any adjustments as we really review this strategically over the next couple of months.
So what was our overall portfolio return number for 2022?
Net of fees, it was for the calendar year, it was minus 10.6%.
Yeah, it's 10.6, right. Okay. And so, my question is the earlier question really in its simplest form is how does that stack up against comparable size systems?
Yeah. So we have that. You ranked in the 42nd percentile with one being best. And that's for public funds greater than $1 billion.
Got it.
Okay.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, that concludes my report. If there are no other questions.
All right. I'm looking around. I think we all have long faces. That's, it's difficult news to digest and it's challenging. And it sounds like you and Tim are going to be conversing, particularly with respect to certain asset classes and managers. So,
yes, sir.
I think we'll be interested in the outcome of that. Jay, you had your hand up.
Sorry. Just one quick question. I know on page 56, it shows the percentile rank of the fund, and that's where you get the kind of 42. Do you also have the percentile ranks of the policy indices there? I'm just curious what kind of the board's SAA policy look like relative to other plans, given the
that would be on slide 73. And the policy index ranks in the 23rd percentile.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Any other questions for Scott? I'm not seeing any. So thank you, Scott.
Thank you all.
Appreciate it as always. Mr. Price, there you are. Let's take it up for your follow-on staff presentation.
Sure. Obviously, Scott's gone over some of the challenges in the portfolio. I just want to give the board a little bit of breathing room here and mention that, we did see a market turn in November. December's a little choppy. Year to date, despite yesterday's very difficult day in the markets, has been quite strong. So just some updated numbers. This is through last Friday when I ran this report. But U.S. large cap is up 7% in the first 6 weeks of the year. Small cap up almost 11%. International up 7.5%. So you have seen this sharp rotation there. So, obviously quarterly reports and annual reports, I think end of a year is a natural time to reflect back the year that was. and it was an incredibly difficult investing and geopolitical environment. But you had a first couple months were pretty solid. You had once Russia invaded Ukraine, the market sold off dramatically, rates rising, compressed PE ratios, but earnings held up for the most part last year. And then we kind of saw this return to a risk appetite in the fourth quarter, continuing into the first quarter of this year. So, it's a tale of many different environments here. But we look forward to working with Verus and reviewing kind of some of the underlying drivers of these asset classes and whether they continue to be attractive on a going forward basis. But with that, let me share my screen.
Tim, real quick. One thing that's held up returns has been consumption, right, by the consumer. And there's been some concern expressed that I've seen that people are burning through their savings and are now relying more on credit cards and so forth. Do you see that as a red flag going forward? Do you think that that will be an issue and something to consider with our potential returns going forward?
Yeah, I would say most of our managers are cautious on consumer segment, both from a debt and equity perspective. We've all seen the same charts that show the the collapse in the savings rate, this continued growth in credit card debt, and now we're starting to see softness in the in the auto loan market there. I think the one potentially offsetting factor is their ability to service that debt has increased as well. So the debt load has increased, but the ability to service the debt, so your interest coverage ratio for the consumer is up as well. So there are some mitigating factors there that might lead to a less than apocalyptic outcome, but it's certainly a concern. And we've candidly passed on some investments that had an outsized exposure to consumer discretionary type of pieces. But hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah,
I'm not in the habit of trying to find out who's number one and chasing whatever their strategy might be. But since we're in roughly the 42nd percentile, that suggests we have a number of other plans by comparison that outperformed at least our results during the year. Is there the ability? Certainly, there is the ability. Is there something to be gained by looking at, say, the top four or five plans and seeing fundamental differences in their strategy that from our own that accounted for the returns during calendar year 2022? Just to see if, and I'm not, if we missed something, we missed something. If they found something, that's great, good for them. But I'd like to find out whether or not there really is a potentially fundamental difference between the strategy that are being used by those that are in the upper 42 percentile as opposed to at the 42nd percentile.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think, the caveat there would be the folks who were top performers last year may have been underperformers the year before. And we've seen this heavy rotation between asset classes of, whatever worked in 2021 didn't work in 2022 and is probably working in 2023 so far. And so you get these sharp rotations in there. So I'd want to take a look at that and say, if there are funds out there that are consistently doing better, sure. Happy to steal their ideas. I think with that sharp rotation is probably more asset allocation driven. So people who had a stronger domestic equity bias relative to international and emerging markets certainly have done better. I mean, U.S. equity has been the dominant performer for a decade. Economic theory would say there's going to be a rotation that was overpriced relative to peers. But the U.S. growth story has been dominant, partially. That's fundamental. Partially, that's driven by Fed policy driving interest rates to zero. If you have free money, you can lever, you're going to do really, really well. When rates rise, it's a different story there. So, I think your point's well taken. But from what I've seen, it's been more of a asset allocation dominant approach rather than an implementation driven differentiation.
If I might through the chair, make just sort of a general comment.
Of course.
So, you know, as always, I definitely don't want to get up on my soapbox here, but it might sound like I am. It's always really tempting to compare yourselves to those peer numbers, right? I want to really caution you against that, particularly in your case where you have decided on a strategic direction that is different than most of your peers in the functionally focused portfolio. And you decided on that, presumably because that was the best way to meet your needs and your liabilities, which are different than those of your peers. And it's done a great job so far in doing that, right? It really has, the functionally focused portfolio really has met the bill. It's kept its promise to you. The things that we're talking about in terms of performance are sort of tweaks around the edges, making sure that it's as efficient as it can be structurally. When you compare yourselves to peers, I think you're really starting to talk about, okay, you're starting to question the functionally focused portfolio, maybe. And that I just want to make sure that, you know, you're thinking about that in the right way. So apologies if I sounded sort of.
Well, let me make it clear that I'm not questioning that, because I believe that approach has served us well. But I do believe it's worth looking at some of the things around the edges.
Yeah.
And if there are things around the edges that are also consistent with our approach or can be blended in with our approach, mm-hmm. then I have nothing against looking at those to suggest where we might be able to sharpen our focus.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And apologies if my comments sounded, you know, sort of up on my soapbox.
Okay. Well, so let's turn our attention, unless there's any other trustee questions, I'm going to turn my attention to the scorecard here. Okay.
Oh, you're good. I don't see any other hands up, Tim, so continue.
All right. So page 3 of the CIO report, here's our scorecard of what's meeting expectations and what's not. So we see liquidity, meeting expectations, short duration, high quality, making all the benefit payments from that pool of capital, growth. You know, trailing 5-year return of 6.1, I think 6.1 in an absolute sense is kind of lower than what we'd like to see, but we normally benchmark our expectations over a decade. We are beating a global benchmark, the ACWI, so 0.8% above just the global broad equity benchmark, and doing that with a higher Sharpe ratio. So despite some of the challenges of having a small cap bias, having an emerging markets bias, overall beating that broad global benchmark. Risk diversifying, and again, here the AFL-CIO component really drove this over the past year. But that correlation being a bit higher than we'd like to see, it's coming down. But and when we get to the diversifying pages, we can see the contribution from each manager. But that's still higher than we'd like to see. The trend down is the right direction, but we're not there yet. We say we want a positive real return net of inflation. Well, as we've all talked about over the past year and a half, inflation is, you know, probably one of the better performing asset classes if you could just invest in inflation. But net of inflation has been a difficult benchmark to beat there. So not meeting expectations on that front. But this is a highly liquid portfolio to be used for rebalancing, and we have done so. I'm going to step into each one of the sub portfolios and make a couple of comments here, and just interrupt me along the way with any questions. Liquidity sub portfolio. This is our, you know, super safe, just make benefit payments portfolio. My comment here is really take a look around portfolio average yield. Those numbers in the low 5%. A year ago, those numbers were in the 1-2% range. So yields up rather dramatically. That means prices are down. So you see total returns are negative. This is largely a buy and maintain portfolio. So, you know, we're not locking in the losses there, but we are, you know, looking at reduced prices right now. If you hold it to maturity, you're going to get your coupon and be on your merry way. And that's largely what this portfolio does. So going forward, obviously a much better yield when we discount, you know, future benefit payments. With this higher yield, we can have a smaller liquidity sub portfolio in the future if those yields hold. The growth portfolio, you see anybody who had risk assets, you know, you're seeing a decline in the market prices driving down product assets, AUM, and firm AUM is down. The two exceptions here you'll notice are on the firm-wide basis over the past year, First Eagle up 10%, and Voya up 10%. These are both corporate actions where they did an acquisition. So these are new business lines. That's not organic growth. But
Tim, the way
Yes.
I apologize. If you go back to the previous slide and looking at the one-year total return, they're all negative. Is that just from drawdown? Or because with the yields in the 5%, I don't quite get that.
Yeah, so as interest rates rose, it pushed the price of the bond down. So you'll have a bond, whatever is issued out there is paying its coupon, but as rates rise, prices go down and yields go up. So it's that inverse relationship there. So it's great to have a new higher yield, but that had the effect of pushing the price of legacy bonds down. Now, okay. If you know, if the bond is trading at 96 and you hold it to maturity, does, you know, you'd like to see it trading above par, but you know, it's not as painful. These are not locked in losses.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right, I'm going to go to page 6 here and just take a look at performance of risk assets. So take a look at that top line there, that broad ACWI. This is a global, so U.S., developed markets and emerging markets altogether, down 18%. It was just a rough year. The 5 and 10 year numbers still up in the, you know, 5 year numbers at 5%, 10 year at 8%. That 10 year number is roughly in line with expectations for kind of a globally diversified portfolio. I'd say it's a little on the low side, but not out of line there. So you take a look at the individual managers, domestic equity, no concerns there. Everybody is performing well versus their own index versus kind of our expectations and the broad global benchmark. Take a look at the international. This is where we have challenges. And so you'll notice that my performance in line with expectations is no for everybody in this space. And that's not necessarily a comment on the manager's ability to beat their benchmark. That's a comment on the space. Scott touched on emerging markets just not delivering the return premium relative to developed markets. And we're certainly seeing that with our managers up 3 and 4% over 10 years. That's not what we expect from emerging markets. And I would even comment that international equity up 4 and 5%, not really what you expect for that risk there. So while the individual managers have done fine, I think, you know, our value managers are outperforming handily in the past year. Growth really went through that repricing as rates went up. PE ratios came down and you had a lot of that repricing. Plus you had a strong US dollar. So translated back into US dollars, a challenge there. But this is something that it's a risk in the portfolio. It's not quite behaving as expected. And so, you know, we need to work with Verus to understand, are we comfortable on a go forward basis with these risks in the portfolio, the currency risk, sector risk, country risk, et cetera, because things haven't quite shaken out the way we expected. On a more positive front, our global managers doing well. So First Eagle and Artisan, where they're just deploying all around the world and, you know, making that allocation decision between the U.S. and developed markets and emerging markets for us, doing well. And you might imagine that's because both of them have a bit of a U.S. bias to their portfolios over time, just given where the opportunity set has been. If we take a look at kind of the other category here, so the REITs have done fine over long periods of time, a rough year, but long periods of time, they've done fine. High yield, soft. So high yield over 10 years, returning 2%. Again, roughly in line with its benchmark, but just, you know, for the risk, we're assuming that's not a great return. And then risk parity with AQR and Panagora, again, a 3 or 4% return over 10 years is not kind of in keeping with our expectations there. We've had these a shorter period of time, but you know, it's a challenging space there. So again, it's a acknowledge what didn't work, re-examine whether it makes sense to keep it in the portfolio for the future, kind of recognizing where we are today. And so, you know, I'd say more to come on all those fronts there. Last comment on this slide, you know, private markets doing what they're expected to do, providing a premium to the public markets. Challenge there, of course, is getting the money deployed. So we are, you know, continuing to work in the private equity, private credit space and real estate to find opportunities. But over time, that's done well for us. You see a little bit of repricing in the real estate in the 1 year number there. Real estate, I think, is you know, it's been challenging to do the valuations in that space, and they are lagged. But I think our managers are doing a relatively conservative job of maintaining marks there. Private equity, you know, you'll really start to see kind of the tail of 2022 more towards the May period when we get the final fourth quarter results in. And so, you know, we'll be watching that closely. Several managers took their hits in the third quarter, marked the portfolios down. Several did not. So we want to see what the fourth quarter audited numbers look like. But it'll be several months before we see that. Going to go to slide 9 on diversifying. And here's where I'm going to make the comment on the correlation. So you see AFL-CIO has had that 0.8 correlation. Normally, we would expect that number to be be much lower. I think the duration drawdown in connection with the equity market drawdown really hurt this. So it's less of a, again, it's less of a manager specific issue and more the space where they're investing is performing a little bit differently than we expect. The new managers, so Acadian and Sit, much lower correlations. That's what we would want to see there. And with trend following, we're expecting to have somebody identified in the second quarter for trend following. And, you know, depending on the size, that may be coming back to the board for approval. Okay, so go to slide 10, put it all together. And we want to measure upside market capture versus downside market capture. We want more of the upside, less of the downside. So the blue line should always be above the red line. We are maintaining that. You know, obviously it's a closing gap, which, you know, the trend is not what we want to see, but the actual level over 3 years, we're still capturing more of the upside and less of the downside. So good, but we'd like it to be a little bit more of a gap there. And then I would just make a comment here on performance versus that simple target index. Over all trailing time periods, the total fund has outperformed that simple target index and with less volatility, so a higher Sharpe ratio. So we are seeing the correct relationship there versus, you know, versus the simplified target index rather than the very custom target index or policy index that Verus uses. With that, take any trustee questions.
All right. Thank you, Tim. I'm looking at there. David, you have your hand up.
It just seems like with emerging markets that China is such a big component of that. The big question is whether China's going to snap back. And it just seems like there's a lot of headwind towards that. And unless we can do more focused investments like in Latin America or Southeast Asia and so forth, it makes it challenging, right? Just to be heavily weighted into the emerging market space, unless we have a real clear idea where China's going to go.
Right? Yeah, and you know, the caveat there being that China has carried emerging markets for the past 10 years. So as much as with emerging markets writ large has had disappointing performance, if you take China out, it's even worse. So yeah, it's a big chunk and it's been a top performer. So it is the major contributor to positive results. Just to end on a down note.
Yeah, I mean, if I went back and looked at the last 5 or 6 years of commentary from Bloomberg and others on emerging markets, it's always like, we're looking to next year. We think it's really gonna turn around, and it's persistently bad.
Yeah,
it has been, and it's just one of those things. It's not unique to us. Certainly, it's the space.
No, and we've seen some of those persistent patterns over in other spaces. I mean, value underperforming growth in the U.S. equity markets for better part of 13 years.
Right.
That finally rotated back last year.
Yeah.
But that was a long, I mean, that was 13 years of, you know, things not performing quite the way you expect them to. So, you know, forecasts are forecasts. They are imperfect devices, but, you know, I think whenever you see a pattern persist this long, you got to go back and kind of scrub your assumptions and say, has something changed in here, kind of with the fundamental model of what I'm expecting that would cause me to move away from this conviction. If not, it's a screaming opportunity to buy. And that was the case in value last year when the rotation came on. But sometimes things change. So we'll take a look at that.
All right, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, Tim, in line with those comments about re-underwriting, you know, re-underwriting assumptions and kind of revisiting long-held beliefs, maybe you have this teed up already, but I think it would be good to kind of review the underpinnings of just the FFP and expectations there. Maybe when the SAA comes up for revisiting, there was a lot of talk today about performance relative to peers, performance relative to expectations and policy, certainly. And I wonder if you might look at just what we expect FFP to do in up and down markets relative to maybe a normal peer or whatever that might be, and the trade-offs we're making.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, obviously FFP does change the shape and the distribution of your outcomes. And so we can certainly highlight that.
Tim, remind me, what is the schedule for a strategic asset allocation review? I know I should know the answer to that question, but remind me.
Yeah, so we do the full-blown asset liability study about every 5 years. And then annually, we take a look at where capital markets have moved and if we want to make the tweaks. And so what Scott was referring to was that annual cycle of taking a look at, hey, what do we need for the liquidity program in the upcoming year? And we want to change the way we've allocated risk or diversifying assets based upon how markets have moved and the new prices that we're seeing in the market. So prices are down, risk assets look better by comparison on a going forward basis. But certainly you know, all things equal, you want to rebalance into last year's underperformers. And I think what you're hearing us say is we want to make sure all things are equal before we start to rebalance into last year's underperformers.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Tim? I'm not seeing any hands up. So thank you. Lots of information to digest and ponder, but, lots of challenges, that's for sure.
Yep.
All right, thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.